Water is the healer. We go to the beach, we go to the riverside, we listen to water in our gardens for the kind of empathetic response, the kind of connection, the kind of peace, tranquility, harmony that water provides for us. And it's what we need in our bodies to be healthy. It heals us. It sustains us. It's the most valuable thing that we can have on Earth, and we should organize ourselves around it.
That's Peter Neal, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Peter Neal on Water is Life. In Cochabamba, Bolivia, people rose up against the privatization of water. They marched and chanted, El agua es vida, water is life. They drove Bechtel, the U.S. corporate behemoth, out of Cochabamba. How important is clean water? Just ask the residents of Flint, Michigan. Water is a huge issue. We expect it to flow when we open the faucet. Long showers, green lawns, and swimming pools are considered almost a birthright. But with hotter global temperatures, more and more parts of the world are water-stressed. One of the triggers of the uprising in Syria was a prolonged drought. Israel has been using the aquifer in the occupied West Bank, leaving Palestinians with very little, thus exacerbating tensions and conflict. In Bangladesh, desperate people have dug so deep for water that it is contaminated with arsenic, resulting in the largest mass poisoning in history. Our guest today is Peter Neal. He's director of the World Ocean Observatory. He served as president of the South Street Seaport Museum in New York for 20 years. He edited the literary anthology American Sea Writing, and he's the author of The Once and Future Ocean. He spoke at the Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And now, Peter Neal.
So if we begin to look, take the long view and look at the Earth from space, you can conclude perhaps that we've named it wrong. We should not really call it Terra. It should be called Aqua. That blue marble, 70% of the surface of the Earth, covered by water. Water essentially infused in every aspect of our being, whether it's natural resources or whether it's a system that is political, financial, social, and otherwise. It's in our bodies, it's in the food we eat, it's in the things we make and consume. Water, in fact, is pervasive in everything we do. Well, we won't spend too much time on talking about why the ocean matters, but if we begin at the horizon and we look out and we stand and maybe we see a distant smoke of a passing freighter, we see nothing. And in fact, we often just assume that it's a kind of endless separating medium that can be constantly abused, that it in fact can assimilate all kinds of abuse. And we treat it with that kind of ignorance and indifference all the time. My argument is, however, that it's the ocean that connects us. It's not the ocean that separates the continents and separates the people. It's absolutely the opposite. It's from the day that the first sailors left their shores in search of something other, with no real knowledge, that began a process of globalization which exists to this day and which is the process of exchange of goods and people and ideas. And so when you begin to see that the ocean is that kind of plane, is that place where that kind of exchange has taken place over all time, you begin to see it differently, and you begin to give it a kind of understanding and significance that perhaps is not completely shared. So we are a maritime nation. We are a maritime world, and we must be able to move forward with that basic assumption in hand. The ocean affects our climate. We know that. It has for all time. Before anybody ever talked about climate change, the ocean is involved in essentially all of the weather systems and patterns that go around the world, and all of the ancillary and inclusive phenomenon, natural phenomenon that interact in this sort of atmosphere that surrounds our entire globe. Fresh water, of course, is only 3% of the water on Earth, and 2% of that 3% is locked in the poles. So when we talk about fresh water, we're really only talking about 1% of the water, and that's what 7 billion people are subsisting on right now. So when you think about that, and you think about how we waste water and how our water habits, freshwater habits, manifest themselves these days, you begin to understand that there's a serious problem here and that we need to start thinking about and understanding the relationship, say, between fresh water and salt water. Astonishingly, the World Water Forum, which is the sort of global forum on water issues, freshwater issues, draws the line at the salt line. You can go to their conferences, and there'll be 200 or 300 academic papers, and the word ocean is not even mentioned. So you begin to understand that there are these kinds of false, arbitrary divisions and perspectives that exist in the world, and those things are not only bad science, but they're just bad policy. Food, 40% of the protein on Earth today is generated by the ocean. That's going to have to happen and increase over time, particularly as we need to feed several billion more people, and when we begin to understand that the land itself is exhausted. We have taken and consumed the productivity of the land. We've been able to create all kinds of tools, fertilizers, etc., that have been able to increase that productivity to a certain point. But we begin to understand that there are desperate consequences associated with that. And in fact, as we begin to poison the land, as we begin to overpopulate the land, as we begin to see the effect of climate change on the land, we begin to understand that the food aspects, the food potential of the ocean is enormous. Health. We talk a lot about ocean acidification. It's a huge problem, probably the most significant problem affecting the ocean. But one of the great manifestations of this is the bleaching of the coral reefs, and that's, you know, there's a lot of concern about that in terms of tourism and the dive industry and all the rest of it. But the real problem there is that that's the pharmacopoeia. We've exhausted the microbes of land. We're using whatever we're doing with them now essentially to mitigate the effects of drugs that have been already generated. And when you start to look at what is happening in the future, you begin to see, for example, in trials on cancer, about 50% of them right now are derived, the drugs are derived from marine organisms. So there is a huge pharmacopoeia there, an enormous potential that has absolutely everything to do with human health, especially as we get more and more populated and we are threatened by diseases that we don't already know. If you have a climate situation, if you have drought, if you have artisanal farmers that suddenly cannot essentially feed themselves, if you then have a resultant kind of a community of political instability, if you then have opportunistic interventions, whether they be ideological or otherwise, and then you have refugees who begin to leave those places to go to other places and disrupt those places, what you have basically is a water security problem. And you can, and people have, argued that the Middle East situation is a very good example of that. You have the diversion of the Jordan River between Israel and Palestine. You have the path of ISIS, which has followed from the western or the eastern slopes of the Turkish mountains down to the Arabian Sea, followed the Tigris and the Euphrates, followed the roads, which are based on the ancient trade routes which went from water place to water place. And when that water supply is disrupted, then you have a political situation that becomes untenable. Energy. There's wave energy, and there's wind energy, and there's solar energy, and there's mechanical energy that can be derived from the ocean. But in my view, the most important thing about the ocean is that it's the biggest heat pump ever. The geothermal potential of the ocean is enormous, and we have done absolutely nothing to begin to understand how we can make that work. We have some minor attempts that have been subverted over time, but the fact is that the geothermal potential of the ocean as a way to generate energy to drive all kinds of things that we'll need in the future is there for the taking. And finally, finance. All of this is interconnected, and it's interconnected just not in the form of natural connections, circles in science, cycles of conveyance, but it also has its financial interconnections. And those are real, and we cannot just simply dismiss them. We cannot just say, well, they're all bad. The fact is that the world is an integrated place financially now, and in order for us all to survive, we need to understand that and adapt to it. So what I'm asking for, basically, is a value shift. Let's just look at the 19th century and 20th century paradigm. For lack of a better place to start, we'll start with the Industrial Revolution. You could go back further, but the fact is that over the last 100, 150 years, we have essentially created a system of unlimited growth based on consumption and driven by fossil fuels. That's the paradigm. And there have been enormous benefits derived from that. There's no question about that. You just simply can't deny that costs of living, quality of life, all of these things in many, many places have gotten better. But we have now reached a point where the negative consequences overwhelm the benefits. And that's what we are faced with today. And we're faced with it in ways that are incontrovertible. We now understand that the impact of offshore drilling, or the impact of fracking, or the impact of moving oil and its byproducts around, all of the consequences of that have begun to have such enormous negative impacts on how we live and where we live that we have to realize that the age of oil is over. That 19th century paradigm is done. And by the way, the market is telling us we are going to go through a very difficult period, very painful period of transition. We already have thousands of people in the oil sector being laid off. We have an estimated 400 or 500 bankruptcies of oil companies. We have fracking wells and other wells that can't produce because there is no market. Now, some of us can gloat about that, and some of us can say that's a good thing. I think it's an inevitable thing, but it's a very painful thing. Those people who have no longer will not have their houses, will not have their jobs, they could be us. And we shouldn't just dismiss them because somehow they've been tainted by the oil business. The fact is that we all bought into the system. There's not a person in this room who didn't buy into the system one way or another. No matter how you feel now and no matter what you do now, you're part of the problem. We are all in this together. So we need to solve it together. We can't abandon our neighbors. We can't abandon their rights to life. And we need to be able to collectively come together and to understand that there needs to be a new paradigm. And we have to understand that it's now. We have to understand that that paradigm must be adopted immediately. So my new premise is that we enter into a phase of managed growth based on sustainability and enabled by water. And by water, I mean all of the water cycle. I mean that the ocean, the atmosphere, the mountaintop, the descent through the watershed and the aquifers, back to the coast and again, plus all of the cycles of conveyance that circulate water and protein and all the rest of it around the earth, and all of the cycles of upwelling and downfalling that have to do with the health of the water column and those creatures that live there. This is what I mean by the ocean. And that interconnectivity is not new news. Indigenous peoples have taught this to us for years. Whatever indifference we may have, whatever misunderstandings we may have, if we don't understand the wisdom of the teachers, we better understand, make a wisdom of our own, and at least understand that we have to come together in some way. And my guess is that we will find many commonalities of value. So the new paradigm for the future ocean is this idea of a hydraulic society. And that passage from one place to another is a kind of rite of passage in the same way that we make a rite of passage from youth to adulthood, from being illiterate to being literate, to hearing the first music and making music. These are all things that are part of the rite of passage, and they are creative activities. And that creativity is what is called for now. So hydraulic society is simply basing our new life around the movement of water, which is the most precious element on Earth. We can live without diamonds. We can live without gold. We can live without uranium. We can live without chocolate. Coffee? How about coffee? Can we live without coffee? Oh, yeah, I guess you. But we can't live without water. 2-3 days, we die. Our family dies. Our community dies. Our associations die. Our institutions die. Our nation states die. That's the truth. I have a story about a reality show proposal I was involved with, and we took a family of five from northern New Jersey, put them in a room, and gave them the UN daily allotment for basic water needs to meet their cooking and hygiene, etc. And the idea was we'd have 11 episodes. Well, we never got past the pilot because this family fell apart. They couldn't live together. The children went berserk. They couldn't take 45-minute showers. The dad couldn't stand the fact he couldn't wash the car. There was no irrigation for the golf course. The pool was empty. And they literally could not live together within a few days. A few days was all it took. Now, think about that when you think about all the people around the world who don't have adequate water already. Think about the good people down there in California who have now had to cut their water ration by 20% in just 18 months because they didn't want to do it, but they had to do it. And it became immediately clear to government and to citizens and to producers that they were going to have to change their ways. So what we're getting to, however, is this point where there is no denying what needs to be done. So we want to talk about exemplary beginnings. We want to talk about invention. We want to talk about what are the processes that we can engage in, the activities that we can engage in that would begin to make the necessary changes. So I give you a few examples. They're obvious in some ways, but I just came back from Peru, and I got to Machu Picchu. Carried this water bag all the way up. And what you realized there was this civilization was based on water management. It was astonishing to see that built into the architecture was an entire realizable, understood system of collection, distribution, recycling, and all the rest of it. And that allowed them to live, subsist in a way that lasted for a very, very long time until they either were attacked from outside or they got too large and they couldn't essentially continue to base their civilization on adequate supply, and they collapsed, and they collapsed quickly. There's theories about the Aztec civilizations. There's the city of Fetaprasikri in India, where you can go and understand that they had the same thing. They had all these water collections. They had all these water collection systems and cisterns and recycling, all gravity-fed, that was able to support a city of 200,000 or 300,000 people. Today, maybe 15,000 or 20,000 people live in that town. And they don't have enough water. So we have to start to understand that in order to address this problem, we need to start thinking about water as this essential resource, and we need to plan around it. So there are some ideas. Here's an architectural idea. Take a high-rise building and turn the entire building into a water collection system. So lots of water in lots of rainwater in Portland, Oregon. In Oregon, you suddenly are collecting that water, and you're using that water in every way possible. So you're using the gravity decline of the water to essentially generate electricity through either coatings in the pipes or little propellers that essentially they make them all mini generators. You have in the building integrated utilities. So you have people living, people working, people recreating, people having gardens. You have all of these things that are essentially built into the same system that becomes self-recycling, self-cycling. The idea is that you collect it when you can get it, you store it, you augment it if you need it, but if you don't need it, you keep using it over and over and over again, and you create a building that is essentially water neutral. Nothing goes to waste. This is not so stupid. The city of Portland, Oregon is generating electricity, water going through their pipes that are specially coated. The exterior of those buildings could be essentially created the same way, could be treated the same way. So as water slides down the outside of the building, it could be generating electricity, it could be diverted into collection systems, et cetera, and then recycling all the way around. The engineering is not the problem. It's the understanding that we have to use that engineering. So if you look at the Nile River, 800,000 acres in the watershed, something like that, many more than that. I'm not quite sure what the number is. It's enormous, 4 or 5 countries. And this Nile River watershed group hired the Danish Hydrological Institute. These are water hydraulic engineers. And they came in and they did an enormous analysis of the entire river watershed. They essentially documented every aspect, where the water was, how the water moved, what was the seasonal impact, where were the demands, where were the future demands, what would happen under certain climate change conditions. And they projected these things forward and provided this planning document that essentially has created a structure of organization for government and intergovernmental cooperation that will allow for this system to actually support the people that live there. This is not difficult to do, actually, except that you need to have to understand, you need to have the will and the intelligence to understand that this is a way that we're going to have to use to go forward. There's a terrible article I read. It's a memo by a man in Merrill Lynch, reporting to his confrere in the Bank of America about water as an asset class, water as a commodity. And believe me, the smart money is already there. We already have Coke and Pepsi making more profit out of water than they make out of soda. We already have people who have water technology investment portfolios where they're investing in water treatment, filters, pumps. All of the associated mechanical systems are out there. But these things represent a huge opportunity for jobs, new technologies, new opportunities for people who used to be maybe in the oil business that now can come over and work in another place. There is a whole legitimate network of activities that's associated with this. The danger, though, of a privatization of water, of course, is anathema. And there is a water universal water rights document that essentially guarantees that every person on Earth gets 40 liters of water a day, something like that. And after that, you build into how water is used the real cost. What does it actually cost? If it takes 150 gallons of water to make a cup of coffee, we should pay for it. If it takes 1 million gallons of water to build a Volkswagen Jetta, we should pay for it. When I walk down a supermarket aisle, I hear nothing but cascading water. It's the processing, water, not in the price. It's in the packaging, water, not in the price. And all of the byproducts, all of that packaging and all of that processing simply disappears, goes back into the system. It may or may not be corrupted, but it's gone for a long time. And we just assume that at the other end, at the head of the pipe, at the mouth of the river, there will be more. And so we now have situations where we have water at the mouth of the river, and then we have all our sort of economic deals that have been made along the way. And when you finally get to the deals that are made between the United States and Mexico for water to irrigate tomatoes, there's no water. There's no water left because it's all been sold and consumed before it even gets to the last people in line. So the whole idea of understanding that the connectivity of water from upstream to downstream has implications in it with regard, let's say, to governance. If, for example, I am a small town at the head of the river and I want to build a paper plant, jobs, taxes, good people of the town all come together, they cut the deal, and in comes the plant. Out of the plant goes all the waste. And no one cares about what happens downstream. Nobody cares about the town 10 miles down the river. Nobody cares about the coastal fisheries and wetlands. Nobody cares about any of that because we've got what we want. Well, if you can't do that because you're obligated to essentially put the water back in as clean as you found it, or essentially have a process that doesn't corrupt it in the first place, that changes how governance works. So watershed associations suddenly become a very different kind of way of looking at things. We have watershed associations all over the country, but they're marginal. Sort of well-meaning planners and environmentalists and who are trying to figure out how to protect the watershed areas and all the rest of it, but they're not actually taken that seriously. But they represent, I think, a whole new future form of how we govern each other and how we work together to assure that those resources are available to us now and in the future. I mentioned virtual water. Virtual water is basically externalities. It's all of the water that you don't hear or see, but it's the water used to build all the things that we have or want. And when that price structure comes back into play, suddenly things will fall out, and this will be too expensive to have because it is neither that utilitarian and it's too expensive. And we don't need to consume it, because it's priced accordingly. So the economics begin to change as soon as you start making these changes in your perspective. And you can actually measure your own mark, your own watermark. There's a site, Watermarks, on the web, and you can go in and put in all your parameters. You can lay out all your water consumption, how many times you wash your car, how long you take showers, all this sort of thing, what's it cost. And you can actually come out with a kind of water index for yourself and your family. And you could begin to see where your habit could change. And you could begin to essentially begin to change that consumption pattern in such a way that, well, does it really make that much difference? Of course it does. It makes a difference in your life, but then when it's added to the impact on you and you and you and you and you, and suddenly millions of people have changed that habitual habit, we have done it. Government has had nothing to do with it. We have taken that power for ourselves. And we are, we claim, a government that's built on the people and the people's will. And so the people's will doesn't necessarily always have to have a lawyer to enforce it. We can do it ourselves. Plastic bags. Plastic bags are a perfect example. Nobody legislated against plastic bags until people in local neighborhoods and supermarkets went and said, look what it's doing to the beaches. Look what it's doing to the fisheries. Look what it's doing to the seals and turtles. We don't want this to happen in our town. We want to do something about it. My little supermarket had a vote, a cashier's vote. Check out. You got to vote. What do you think about power? Here are three ways to deal with plastic bags. And we voted a system. And these are just simple people, 1,000 people in a small town. And we changed the way that it happens. So if you bring your own cloth bag that you use over and over again, you get a credit. If you don't bring a bag and you want a plastic bag, you pay extra. And it was fascinating to watch. The guy who owns the supermarket says, you can't believe how fast this changed. We're only talking about pennies. But pennies matter to people. And those pennies were suddenly enough for somebody to say, well, if I bring my own cloth bag, I don't have to pay, and by the time I've finished, I've saved $20 a month on the penalties for using this thing. And now what? Chicago, Los Angeles, Portland, I don't know, New York City, no plastic bags. Why is this so great? Is because, and why didn't it happen before? Because guess what plastic is? Plastic is oil. And the oil companies didn't want to have that. The plastic companies didn't want to have that. They wanted to keep making plastic bags and plastic bags and plastic bags, and we're all worried about the plastic that's all floating all over the ocean, and yet we control the source. We can change that behavior overnight. So sell your plastic bag stock if you haven't already done so. Should have sold your oil stocks, by the way, a long time ago.
You're listening to Peter Neal. Water is life. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I have to say that I'm a little bit amused by the divestment situation around investment policies of certain universities where, you know, they've resisted the divestment situation. You sort of wonder why, and you realize that there's this weird little competition that happens to go along between money managers that operate endowments in college and universities, and there's a big deal about whether you got a 12% return or a 12.6% return. And the colleges actually really care about this. This is actually more important to them than the food. You know, the colleges that go around and say, well, gee, you know, we've got the best food. Well, the students may appear, but that's not what the trustees are interested in. That's that return on investment. So they find some very elaborate justification for not doing it, not divesting, and guess what? In the last year, how much value has been lost in those endowments because they didn't sell those stocks? And it's because they weren't thinking. They were thinking complacently. They were not thinking with any sense of the future. They were not actually thinking even with the context of their own mission. So we have to start to begin to understand that these behaviors are pervasive. There's everywhere. Now, I didn't know what to do. I mean, people keep saying, well, Peter, this won't happen. This is such a poppycock idea, so idealistic. I mean, I had a conversation just the other night with somebody who just couldn't do anything but tell me all the reasons why it wouldn't work. And one of the things she came back to was the laws are all written against you. I said, well, actually, no. Where is she? Where is our nature's trust? Is she in the room? You know, I mean, I read that book right here, authored in the University of Oregon, and suddenly I realized that in Roman law, in English common law, and in American law, there is this thing that basically says that the natural resources of the land are owned by the people. They can be exploited and licensed, but only in the context of sustainability and their availability for future generations. So I'm all over this, and I'm all over Children's Trust. Is anybody here from the Children's Trust? God bless. God bless. These folk, I'm sure you all know about it because you're local, but where I come from, it's new news. But these folks are bringing cases in states and now in the federal court where essentially they're using that doctrine as a way to challenge the laws and procedures that have been created that have essentially nibbled away at the prerogatives and many of the institutions like the EPA and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, all of these things which essentially have been nibbled at and accepted, little languages and bits of languages that sort of takes parts of it away. And who are the plaintiffs? all the plaintiffs are our children. 18 years old. The future generation are the plaintiffs in this case because, like indigenous people, they understand that what we are doing is we are taking away, allowing these assets to be taken away from us and essentially exported. They don't go back into the system unless we have a way to make it so. And here's a legal foundation that allows it to happen. So hats off to the Children's Trust. So the new paradigm, listen, if you've got a better one, come on up here. It's yours. But if you don't, then think about this one. Think about this idea, because it's not a function of not having the technology or not understanding the science. Not even a question of not having the financial resources. We have those things. What we don't have is the political will, and we've allowed the political will to be essentially taken away from us, and we have essentially opted for complacency. Now, many of you in this room are organizers and activists, and that's the work that has to be done. But look how few of you there are. There's nowhere near enough of you. So here's an idea that might, through amplification and aggregation and talks like this and gossip amongst yourselves and enlisting your children, that might essentially create a new community of citizens of the ocean who understand this new paradigm and who will go out into the world and say, no, we're not going to do it that way anymore. Mom, I don't want to do it that way. You're wasting water. You know, Dad, forget the car. What's the car? Leave the car dirty. Let the rain wash the car. Forget the golf. Golf doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. There's another way to relax. There's another way that doesn't take up all this land and consume all this water. There are a million different ways that can happen. In terms of is it a revolution or an evolution? Well, I'm calling it an evolution. But it's a fast one. It's not a revolution, but it's a fast evolution. And it's driven by human will. It's driven by each and every one of us. We are each and every one of us an evolutionary. And it's up to us to get out onto the barricades and to make that happen. We live in a collaborative age. We have the tools by which we can partner with each other. We can communicate with each other. We can essentially collaborate with strangers. We can talk to people all over the world. We can engage people in understanding our ideas and our behaviors and suggest to them that they might do the same, receive their ideas in exchange and bring those back into your community. So the whole idea of a collaborative age is all part and parcel of the values that are inherent in the paradigm. What I'm talking about is in a time of trouble, a time of strife, a time of division, a time of pain. Water is the healer. We go to the beach, we go to the riverside, we listen to water in our gardens for the kind of empathetic response, the kind of connection, the kind of peace, tranquility, harmony that water provides for us. And it's what we need in our bodies to be healthy. It heals us. It sustains us. It's the most valuable thing that we can have on Earth, and we should organize ourselves around it. So read the Pope. Has anybody read Laudato Si? I've read it. It's amazing. It's an amazing document. Has anybody read The Law of Mother Earth? Now the Law of Bolivia, soon to be the Law of Ecuador, which has language in it that is astonishing in terms of accepted legal principles about the disposition, ownership and disposition of natural resources. So it's out there. It's out there. Work has been done. There's more work to be done. You have people in religious communities, in indigenous communities, in progressive communities. We have people all over the world who understand this viscerally. And if you engage them and have them realize that they are part of a community and that we're all looking out for each other, then we have an opportunity to actually implement the paradigm and go forward. So I'm calling that the ocean ethos. It's not an ethic. An ethic is sort of a didactic law. You're either yes or no. It's either ethical or it's not ethical. Ethos is more flexible. Ethos is more inclusive. Ethos says we're all going to express this morality and this identification with nature in a different way. And we may do it through a religious perspective or a cultural perspective or whatever it may be, but we're going to do it, and we're going to do it together. Now, when it comes to the end of the day, I gave a radio interview this morning, and the woman said to me, Sacramento, California, she said, Peter, it'll never happen. Nobody will do this. Nobody's going to give up what they've got for something else. I said, well, you know what? Here's the difference. I get that. I understand that. People are telling me that and demonstrating that behavior all the time. We see it all around us. But there's a difference here. The difference here is that without water, we have no choice. The urgency is paramount. There is no complacency acceptable. You can choose to what? Collapse? Die? In the name of what? Chocolate? No. You can choose to essentially realize that the thing that you need the most is not only the element, but the idea that will essentially allow us to survive. And I keep talking about this. People say it's a little shrill, Peter. You ought to kind of calm down a little bit, you know. You know, don't be quite so noisy. Don't move your hands quite so much, you know. Lower your voice. It's going to be okay. And I keep saying, no. I'm an advocate. Advocates don't lower their voices. They raise their voices. That's what advocates do. And when we... So no more calm. No more New Age, no more tapes that, you know, of mindfulness. You won't have any mind to mind if we don't deal with this issue, and we need to deal with it sooner or later. So think about the new paradigm. Think about your reaction to it. Think about how you can essentially contribute to the new hydraulic society, and let's all enter arm in arm into the 21st century and make it a place that lives up to our own expectations. You know, we have these high expectations of ourselves. We call ourselves exceptional. Well, exceptional people do exceptional things. They don't deny. They don't leave it for somebody else. They don't take it so somebody else can't have it. They basically stand up and say, the exception here is a new behavior that is going to enable us to come together as a global community connected by the ocean and to move forward generation after generation. Hallelujah. Thank you. If anybody wants to ask me a question, I'd be happy to rant on. What should college students do? Is that the question? Yeah, well, vote. How about that? I don't want to hear anything more about millennials sitting out. I don't care who you vote for. Well, I do. But I want you. I don't want you. Because essential to this is that it's a collective action of individuals. So that's your greatest opportunity and privilege. On top of that, you can join any one of the organizations that are here and any one of the thousands of organizations that are available to you that's doing this kind of work. Thirdly, you can take a Citizens of the Ocean pledge, and you can make those simple modifications for your own behavior. And you don't have to brag about it. Just do it. And maybe you say, well, you know, when I did this, what do you think? What do you think? Maybe you should do it. Let's do it. Mom, Dad, let's just change this. Why can't we change this? And so as individuals and as young people with energy and intelligence and education, you have nothing. You must be part of the ethos. If you aren't, we're in real trouble because you're the ones that are going to suffer more than anybody else. And your children are the ones that we're doing it for. That's what you can do. Anybody else?
From what I gather, there are many communities that have reclaimed sewage water and are using it in agricultural operations and other municipal uses as well. And to speak to that, or as a water policy.
This is a system that is condemned in certain places like us with our sort of hygienic fetishes. There are health policy issues. There are chemical challenges and disease issues. On the other hand, I have no problem with this whatsoever. I have no problem. All we're doing is we're treating that water. We're treating sewage water anyway, and we're just dumping it in the ocean. And by the way, we're using systems that are supposed to be combined, integrated systems, right? Until you get halfway down the system and the sewage pipes and the storm drain pipes actually come together. So you have them come together. A town I lived in had this situation. They had the two pipes came together, sewage from here, storm drain from here. They commingled. They went back, separated again, down to the sewage plant. Half of the water that was the so-called storm drain water, now half sewage, goes out into the bay. The other half, which is supposed to be sewage, which is now half freshwater storm drains, with all the stuff, goes into the treatment plant. So I said, well, that seems a little odd. Why wouldn't you just spend a little bit of money and close the gap? Oh, you know, we can't do it. It costs too much money. And then I said, well, tell me about this. What happens to the volume of this water when it gets to the treatment plant? They said, well, we close the plant. The plant can only handle so much volume per day. So if we have a weather event, right, we just close the plant so we don't break the plant, and all the water goes into the bay. So now all the water is going in the bay. The sewage and the storm drain are all going into the bay. I said, well, how long does it take to recalibrate, open up the plant again, getting it back running, and getting it recalibrated to its efficiency? So 3 to 5 days. How many events do you have? 100? So the plant is never working. The plant never was working. It was unbelievable. I said, is this really true? You're joking me, right? What you're really saying is that this sewage treatment plant is working at less than 50% efficiency all the time. He said, yeah. Now, you have situations where, well, in Maine, we have a town called Poland Spring. It's owned by Nestle. The taxpayers built the road, goes south down to Massachusetts. Every 15 minutes, 10,000 gallons of water comes out of that well, and disappears from the state. The royalty is negligible, and by the way, it's set by the company. The amount of water that's taken is also measured by the company. We have no one who stands there and says, oh, you reported that you took 5,000 gallons, but actually you took $7,000. No, that doesn't happen. So it just goes out. They are the biggest political contributor to the legislature in Maine. They are an enormous contributor to our notorious governor. And he wants to privatize all the water. Now, it's an interesting example because there are three or four towns around Poland Springs. Poland Springs is a very small town, and they are all part of the same aquifer. Their wells are running dry. So they're going to start to sue their municipality and sue the government in order to essentially protect their water rights, which are being stolen and exported at a subsidy provided by everybody else in the state. And then they all use plastic bottles. The city of Sao Paulo, Brazil, 12 million people. Suddenly there's no water, no fresh water. Why? Well, climate, extreme weather, deforestation, erosion, outdated plants, no maintenance, corruption. It's a series of activities that are all interrelated and comes to a point when suddenly the system is broken. Take that as a metaphor that says, okay, let's think about that. Climate, extreme weather, deforestation, different changes of the landscape, you know, cheap technology, cutting corners to maintain it, corruption in its operation, in its sort of political supervision. And what you have is a process that could be actually described to cover many, 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 many more things than just the town municipal water supply of Sao Paulo, Brazil. It just all happened. Nobody knew. And now suddenly they have to tank water into Sao Paulo in order for the people to essentially wash their hands, wash their clothes, cook their food. So it's not as if this is new news. And it's happening in many, many places. And it's happening in the U.S. I mean, Flint, Michigan. Just a tragedy when you think about it. Just such a tragedy. You know, you have a system that is essentially, it's working, sort of. Some guy trying to please some guy to score some kind of ideological point or cut a few bucks from the operating budget makes an uninformed decision, which ends up now with a system that is corroded, old system of lead pipes, which is corroded, which now has lead in the children, has destroyed that community's, shut the system down, and is going to have to be completely rebuilt at costs of hundreds of millions of dollars, of taxpayers' dollars. Not only the town doesn't have anything, the state is going to, hey, the governor's not going to be accountable. He's in charge, but he won't be held accountable. And us, we're going to pay for that. There's a, you know, Obama put $80 million for it to go to Flint to help the people to deal with that. Real estate values are destroyed. Who's going to move there? Oh, by the way, the GM plant in Flint found that the water that was being used out of the Flint River was corroding the new parts on the assembly line. So the state found $200,000 or $300,000 to put the plant back on the old system, off the water that was coming out of the Detroit treatment plants. And so GM, they went ahead with clean water. The people in the town, who happened to be heavily, majority, poor, minority, people already under enormous stress, nobody gave a damn. They didn't even think about it. And when the people that did understand what was going said something about it, they were shouted down. They were told, leave it alone, until it all falls apart. Use that again as a metaphor. You have a situation. You have changing circumstances. You have political ideologies. You have sequestered funds. You have all of these things that essentially build the case against the social service. And, okay, you know, you're going to cut this health program or that educational program. We all hate that just as much. But in this case, there's no water. You know, and guess who's providing the water? Nestle. And I'm told by Michael Moore that the governor's wife is a special political consultant to the Nestle company. Go figure. This is intolerable. And it's just not the 300, 400, 500 people in this room that need to know about it. It's many, 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 many more people that need to know about it. And we need to provide them alternatives. We need to be able to say, look, if you do it this way, this won't be able to happen. If you understand that these things we need to be protected ourselves against corruption or protect ourselves against these sort of ideological invasions on common sense, then maybe we can protect our lives and we can protect our children's lives as we go forward. So take back the system. Thank you.
That was Peter Neal. Water is life. He spoke at the Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Peter Neal is the director of the World Ocean Observatory, and he served as president of the South Street Seaport Museum in New York for 20 years. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices on environmental issues rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Maud Barlow, Sandra Steingraber, Naomi Klein, David Suzuki, Bill McKibben, Vandana Shiva, and many others. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Peter Neal, Water is Life, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Matt Laubach recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.